Studio 360.
On today's show, we're looking at how a certain traditionalist vision of America really coalesced in mid-20th century culture, and sometimes became weaponized.
We proclaim ourselves indeed as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. Good night, and good luck.
That's David Strathairn playing the celebrated mid-century TV newsman, Edward R. Murrow, in Good Night and Good Luck, nominated for 6 Academy Awards in 2006. It's one of several latter-day big-deal movies about heroes of the Red Scare in the late 1940s and 50s, men who stood up against the hysterical anti-communism propagated by Joe McCarthy and his cohorts, the blacklisting of writers and performers accused of being commie sympathizers. That is how the story's been told. But actually, it's only half the story, because there were dozens of women blacklisted as well. University of Oregon professor Carol Stabile's new book, The Broadcast 41, is about 41 women of the left working in TV and radio, targeted by the blacklists. And what lots of people don't realize is that it all began with a literal list, this extraordinary pamphlet that also started you, Carol, down this path to your book. So explain what Red Channels was.
Red Channels was a report of communist influence in radio and television, and it was a special publication, they called it, of a group called the American Business Consultants. And they would list the names of all the people who, in their opinion, had proved less than 100% American in their view, or were otherwise suspected of being subversive.
Yeah.
And so they used that list of names to smear people and to start really ramping up anti-communist activities in broadcasting. In June 1950, they published Red Channels. And Red Channels was quickly used by people in the anti-communist movement, especially the American Legion,
the veterans organization.
To start campaigns to get people removed from television shows.
The people organizing it were mostly, or many of them, were former FBI agents?
Yeah, that's right. The three men who founded the American Business Consultants were all former agents. At the end of World War II, as intelligence agencies downsized, a lot of these men left the Bureau or military intelligence to work in the burgeoning Cold War security industry. And these three men did just that. People in the industry called it the smear and clear business because it was clear that what they were doing was setting out to ruin people's reputations and then to charge people money to clear their names.
Really? And it was that explicitly corrupt?
It was that explicitly corrupt. J. Edgar Hoover was actually very angry at these agents because he thought that they had stolen a number of files from the FBI in order to set up their clearance business.
Huh.
So the relationship between the Bureau and the American Business Consultants at the beginning was very acrimonious.
They basically worked in terms of the smearing part and pressuring the entertainment industry through, as you say, in broadcasting, through threat of advertising dollars, right? The sponsors were easier to scare.
Right. First of all, they would publish the names in their own publication. And then they would go to the sponsors or in some cases the networks and say, look, this person's a communist. We proved it in our publication. And so now you need to hire us, first of all, to make sure that you don't have other communists who are employed by your business. And second of all, so we can clear the talent so you can continue to use them.
Uh-huh. Your stories about these women are really fascinating to me because I didn't really consider any of them as, oh, these were political people, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were just, oh, you know, Judy Holliday, for instance.
Right.
To my mind, the great comic actress of the 1940s and early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Here she is with William Holden in Born Yesterday from 1950.
Nobody's born smart, Billy. You know what the stupidest thing on earth is? An infant.
Where you going against babies all of a sudden?
Nothing. I've got nothing against a brain that's 3 weeks old and empty. But after it hangs around for 30 years and hasn't absorbed anything, I begin to wonder about it.
What makes you think I'm 30?
I didn't mean you.
Oh, yes, you did.
I swear.
You suddenly know how to get me sore.
I'm sorry.
30? Do I look 30 to you?
No.
But what'd you say it for?
I don't know. How old are you?
29.
So, she was political? Funny Judy?
Yeah, she was actually very political. And as you point out, she was such a tremendous comic actress, but always struggled against the ways in which she was being boxed in the industry. But she came from a very political family. Her uncle was a Yiddish language newspaper writer.
She testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
She was coached very carefully about her appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee. I think that the word was, play the dumb blonde for all it's worth.
Which she played often on screen.
Yeah, which she hated.
Yeah.
Right? She was very narrowly typecast.
Sure.
And that was a source of great frustration to her.
So she's blacklisted. She makes it through the HUAC testimony, even though she doesn't give any names of communists.
Right.
Doesn't go to jail. And she kept working, right?
Yeah, she did keep working. But I'm imagining that there aren't that many people who remember Judy Holliday.
Man, she's one of the great ones. Another of the women in your book is the great Ruth Gordon, of whom I first became aware of when she appeared 20 years after Red Channels as a 70-ish woman in Harold and Maude.
That little treat. Trouble, come on. Look at it. Oh, it's suffocating. Well, it's the smog. You know, people can live with it, but trees, it gives them asthma. They can't breathe.
Huh?
The leaves, look, they're turning brown. Harold, we have got to do something about this light.
What?
We've transplanted it to the forest.
You can't do that.
Why not?
This is public property.
Well, exactly.
That's Ruth Gordon and Bud Cort in Harold and Maude in 1971. I remember when that came out, it was a revelation for lots of people to discover this fantastic old actress. Where'd she been? But in fact, as you describe in the book, she had a successful career as an actress starting in the silent pictures and then in the 1940s wrote Oscar-nominated films with her husband Garson Kanin before she was blacklisted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wrote for a number of Tracy Hepburn vehicles.
Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, so Adam's Rib and Pat and Mike. But she had been a writer for a long time.
So she's blacklisted. What happened to her?
Gordon, like Holliday, and like a lot of other women who wound up on the blacklist, went back to theater. And so she mostly worked on stage throughout the 1950s and into the 1960s when she picked up the roles in Rosemary's Baby and later in Harold and Maude. So the negative impact of it was that people like this were really prevented from moving into television. And Gordon's papers show that, you know, she was really interested in moving into television because
you could
actually make money.
Yeah.
And it meant that you had a better shot at getting some of the best roles on Broadway if people had already seen you on TV. So that route being shut down for them meant that they may do, but they were never the successes they could have been.
And I'd never thought as much as I had when I read your book about the fact that theater, New York theater and Broadway, were pretty much exempt from the blacklist Red Scare thing, right? It was like a free zone.
No, it was. In so many ways, writing this book reminded me that it was a sanctuary for progressive writers and for progressives in media industry because its economic model wasn't amenable to the kinds of pressure.
Right. No advertising.
Right. Yeah.
So another person you write about is Gypsy Rose Lee, who is best known now as the title character for the Broadway musical Gypsy, based on her memoir about her show business upbringing and life, or her stage mother becoming a stripper.
Starting now, honey, everything's coming up roses.
And in the supposedly super square 1950s and early 60s, she was this funny mainstream celebrity on TV, on game shows and talk shows.
Yeah, Gypsy Rose Lee is such an interesting figure in the history of media. She was also a successful novelist. In the 1940s, she published a novel called The G-String Murders. It's a really, really smart piece of writing. She was a painter. And that's the thing that struck me about these women is that you couldn't just be an excellent person or an excellent writer or whatever in the 1950s, if you're a woman and you wanted to be successful, you had to be stellar.
Right.
She was going to be the host of her own talk show.
In 50.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And she was very, very bright, very articulate. They
funny.
Loved her. So super funny.
Yeah.
And the American Legion started organizing against her, claiming that she was a member of the Communist Party. The FBI was spreading rumors that she had, in the 1930s or 1940s, been carrying this pocketbook full of communist propaganda that she would thrust upon people at every occasion.
Communist stripper,
exactly.
Subverting Americans' men.
Exactly. So they spent much of the summer organizing and putting pressure on advertisers, sponsors, and networks to get her removed. She just signed a contract for a talk show, and by the fall of that year, she was off the air. And that was something that didn't come around again for a lot of these women, right? If you think about actress Hazel Scott, who was the first African-American woman to have her own variety show.
Right, which I didn't even know about. I mean, I'd heard of I knew Hazel Scott as a musician.
Right.
In fact, here she is singing The Man I Love.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong. The man I love, and when he comes my way, I'll do my best.
That's the singer Hazel Scott, who was also an actress, who also, and this makes more sense about her political involvement, was married to the great charismatic New York minister and politician Adam Clayton Powell Jr. What were her independent political activities like in the 40s and 50s?
Well, Hazel Scott protested segregation in performances. She actually refused to perform as anyone but herself in Hollywood because she knew that that would give her control over her image. She was worried that if someone else wrote a character for her, she would be forced to speak those words.
Interesting.
She was also part of a landmark civil rights lawsuit. She had been performing, I believe, in 1949 and was refused service at a restaurant in Pasco, Washington, and so brought a lawsuit against the restaurant and won.
And Hazel Scott testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Did that play well? Did that help clear her?
No, it didn't. And so her show goes on the air in July of 1950 and gets really, really wonderful critical reviews.
Again, a black woman hosting a variety show in 1950 on television.
Right,
amazing.
Right. But what they say come September, and the show is canceled 2 weeks after she appears before the House Un-American Activities Committee, what they say is one of those, you know, sort of nebulous excuses that people made all the time. Well, you know, it wasn't getting advertising dollars.
Yeah, not a good cultural fit.
Yeah. She was a musician, so she could still pick up gigs, and she traveled a good bit in Europe. She wound up moving to Paris and living there until around 1968. So I think she was one of the people who just found it really hard to get gigs in the United States after the blacklist.
Right. As you were looking at this history and chronicling it, did you imagine, like, what if the blacklist hadn't happened? Would we be different today as a result?
I like to think so. I think that that's one of the reasons that the FBI paid so much attention to popular culture, is that even though people in the academy kind of looked down their noses at popular culture, I think that the Bureau knew how massive the influence of these images and representations was going to be. And so they took it really seriously. The FBI had their own very effective PR division that was reading popular culture, criticizing anything that kind of diverged from their vision of what it meant to be American men and women, and then retaliating against people who criticized their version of American identity. I do think that these representations matter and mattered. Here is a group of people who are really thinking about how to make anti-racist popular culture in the 1940s and the 1950s. You know, there was a sense that when it came to representations that were progressive, things got stalled. And things that might have happened in 1950 didn't happen until the late 1970s, right? Because Roots is, what, 1979?
Right, 1977.
And these, again, these were people who wanted to make culture that looked at that. And I think that eradicating that meant that the successive generations of women came up through industries and in climates that were really hostile.
Right.
Audiences, too, were denied the ability to see these different cultures, to see these different perspectives for decades, principally because of the blacklist.
Carol Stabile's new book is called The Broadcast 41, Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist.